Welcome to You Had to Be There, the podcast where we deep dive into the world of the music industry. I'm your host, Julia Gomberg. This week, I'm super thrilled to be joined by Kristen Robinson, who is a senior correspondent at Billboard and the host of Billboard's On the Record, a new podcast that unpacks the biggest stories at the crossroads of music, business, and technology. Over the course of her career, Kristen's becoming a leading voice on music publishing, tech, and the rise of AI in the music industry. Also excited to announce that you can now watch clips of the biggest moments from this interview over on You Had to Be There's Instagram and TikTok, which you can find at the letter U Had to Be There Pod. After the episode, also be sure to check out Kristen's curated music playlist, which you can find in the episode show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Hi, I'm Kristen Robinson. I'm a senior correspondent and host for Billboard. I primarily report on the music business. And I'm from Fort Worth, Texas originally, but now I live in Los Angeles.
Amazing. Yeah, I was curious where you're from. So you made the trip out to LA and never looked back, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But I do still say y'all, so it'll pop out. You'll know.
There it is. Love that. Well, cool. Yeah, I'm really excited to have you. Thank you so much. This will be a super interesting conversation. I know you do a lot in the journalism and AI and music business space. But before we get into that, I'd love to sort of hear, like, what was your relationship with music like growing up?
So growing up, my relationship with music was really playing it. I've been playing music my whole life. I think I started piano lessons when I was 5, and always was like the person who was trying to get the solo in choir and all that stuff. But, you know, like that, my love of music really stemmed from just really enjoying playing it, and wrote a lot of songs growing up, did musical theater, just like basically any way that I could find, a way in my hometown, which did not have that much music, to be part of it. I did that. And so I was actually very sure pretty much my whole life that I would do something related to music. I just didn't know what. So
that's funny because, yeah, one of my questions was going to be like, if you weren't doing, you know, music journalism, what would you do as your career? So it sounds like still music.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Still music. I just wouldn't be a journalist. I would work at a record label or something. I don't know. I haven't thought too hard about it recently. Because I love my job so much. So it's not something I've thought to pivot out of or have any interest in pivoting out of. But I feel that music is like the through line across all of the interests I've had pretty much my whole life. And I can't really see myself straying from that, even though this industry can be kind of insane.
So. Yeah. Well, that's a testament to how much you must really love it, because it's true. Yeah. So what did you study in school?
I went to USC and I did their music industry program. So amazing. I've been strong on this for a while. The journalism stuff came later. So kind of what we were just talking about before, I was always very sure about the music part and I just didn't know exactly how I wanted to do it. So I looked into a bunch of programs at various schools that had either pop music performance or music industry, music business, that kind of thing. And USC just felt like the right choice because it got me out to LA and I knew needed to make a lot of connections to break into a tough industry. So I didn't want to spend 4 years doing a degree that I didn't think I would do anything with. And I think a lot of people go into college and will do something more general. Maybe it's because they just don't know what they want to do yet. But I already knew what I wanted. So I wanted to do something. It was almost like picking a trade. I already knew exactly what I was training for and what I wanted. But yeah, you know, the idea of what I wanted to do in the music industry definitely changed over the course of that program. And I'm grateful to it because it introduced me to all different areas of the business.
It sounds like it was very intuitive for you to like kind of know that was what you wanted and just having to sort of find the structural concepts of like to get you to sort of where you wanted to go. Did you always enjoy writing, would you say?
I always enjoyed writing. I think my first love was definitely songwriting specifically. Right. One of the things I really like about songwriting is that there's like a very clear defined structure to songs, especially pop songs. You have your verses and choruses and bridges, and they all tend to follow somewhat of a similar formula and rhyme scheme. And so I always loved just thinking about like various phrases that I pick up throughout the day that I thought were interesting and then seeing if I could work them into a structure. And I think honestly, that is what I like about being a journalist and a writer now. Although songwriting is much more poetic and journalism is so much more, I mean, it's facts. There's not really too much room for flowery artistic flair, but I do love when I'm writing like a feature or something and I've done 5 interviews for it and trying to work in quotes from 5 different people into the right places. There's something really satisfying about figuring out the structure of how to tell a story. So yeah, I always did songwriting. And when I was in college, I started writing for Once to Watch, which is Live Nation's rising artist blog. But beyond that, I didn't realize that music journalism was really an option until the end of school.
Wow. So how did that turn into sort of like that moment where you're like, oh, I could do this as like my professional career?
I think I was getting towards the end of my time at USC and I was looking out at the future and I was like, I got to get a job. I need to figure this out. Like I've tried everything. I did so many internships when I was in college and every single time I do something different because I was like, okay, I'll try sync licensing at a label this time. And then I'd be like, eh, that wasn't it. Then I would try publicity at a different label. That wasn't it. I worked for Live Nation for a bit. That wasn't it. I kept trying all these things. But the one thing that I really enjoyed was just writing for this blog throughout school. And so at the end of school, it was my last semester. I felt like my resume was fine. Like I could probably get a job eventually, like at a label or something like that. And the one thing I hadn't taken seriously was my writing. And I didn't even know if I was good or not. But I just loved the fact that being a writer meant that you got to talk to such interesting people. So I applied to Variety because I knew that they had some music editorial in there. I wasn't confident in my skills as a writer. So I actually applied as an event marketing person because I thought maybe my resume supported that. Cause I had this, like, I had a lot of experience throwing events and working at Live Nation. I was like, I think I can spend my resume to look good for this one. But really, like, my secret plan was to get in the building so I could talk to the people who wrote about music there.
Yeah.
And it ended up working. I ended up getting that gig and immediately was like, I want to meet Shirley Halperin, who was running like our music coverage at the time. And that's how it got started for me. She just kind of took a chance on me and saw how eager I was and how I actually knew some stuff about the business. So she gave me a few stories to try and see if I was any good. And a few of them were business related. And I think we both realized pretty quickly that I was more valuable writing about the business side of music more than just artists, because there were so few people who were trained in covering music business. So that's kind of how it started. And then from there, yeah, I just kept building my portfolio. But I actually ended up, I mean, that internship was spring 2020, which was not a good time.
No, it was not.
We canceled the internship program.
Wow.
And I just got like, which is completely understandable, by the way, because I was an event marketing intern and there were no events.
Right.
So they canceled all the events. I didn't have an internship anymore. And Shirley let me keep writing for her on a freelance basis. But like I was thrown into the deep end, like on a freelance basis, I wasn't on the intern payroll. So I had to write and pitch ideas that were actually worth paying for. Wow. And I had almost no experience. So that was a really big challenge in trying to figure out what they were looking for and how to become a better writer without basically any training wheels. But I ended up kind of figuring it out. And so I was freelancing on the side, had to get a real job in the meantime.
Wow.
Because it wasn't like it wasn't enough to pay my bills. So I worked for an indie label for a year while freelancing. And then I ended up at Billboard.
Wow. So. The rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history.
That's amazing and like such a testament to your passion and your drive for it. Because I mean, I always think, especially being in school or starting out your career during 2020, is like an Olympic sport, to be honest. Like,
yeah, I wouldn't recommend it.
No. Yeah. And I was laughing a little because I worked at TuneCore during the pandemic and my friend had gotten a role there for the events marketing manager. And I felt so bad because all he did was plan webinars. Like, that was the event, because that's all we could do. It was such a time.
That was a dark, dark period and really changed everything. And, I'm really grateful I was able to find a job at that time. Yeah. There were not many out there. So luckily everything ended up turning out okay. And the amount of time that I wasn't spending socializing with friends, like I would have done as like a new grad, I was just writing. Mm. Was I a little miserable? Yeah. But like, it did help me get better as a writer, because there's nothing else I could be doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, what a time.
Truly. How much would you say like it prepared you for the more business side of music versus like sort of what you figured out as you started your journalism career outside of school?
I think that my music business degree at USC actually prepared me better for being a music business journalist than it prepared some of my friends who like just went to work like straight up in the actual business, because it felt like that degree plan was just like a survey of all the different job options out there and just teaching you a little bit about everything.
Right.
And as a journalist, that's really helpful. Like, I know a little bit about publishing, a little bit about how contracts are written. I know a little bit about how a music festival's run. I think it's always helpful to have a bird's eye view, but it's not extremely helpful if you end up working at TuneCore to know how a music festival works.
Right.
Like, you kind of don't need to know that. So I would say I thought it was really helpful. I'm a big proponent of doing that program, but I would say you should only do a program like that if you're absolutely certain you want to do that, because it does pigeonhole you.
Right.
So,
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As opposed to a continuation of what you studied, it was sort of like taking that and then reinventing it into something that works for you, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think also like, I totally agree about the pigeonhole thing. Cause it's like, how are you supposed to know until you're in it? And then when you're in it, and if you don't like it, you don't really have much else to compare it to. But if you get more of the holistic view of what everything is, then there's more curiosity of like kind of what you were saying. You got to try out a lot of different perspectives and roles within the industry to figure out what you really like.
Yeah. I would say it was helpful in the end, but it's not for everyone.
When you started your career in journalism, where was AI at? And like, when did it become like an interesting topic for you?
AI was just like nowhere in my head when I first started. Like, I wasn't thinking about it. I had heard here and there people were trying to generate music using AI, but anytime that I heard the results of those tools, it sounded so bad that I just was not concerned. Like, I do remember hearing one, I think in 2020, it was like a Travis Scott. People use AI as like an umbrella term for a lot of different variations of using it. I remember hearing this like AI Travis Scott song my last year of college. It was like spring 2020, I think, when I heard it, and I was blown away by it. But the thing was, I don't really know how much AI was actually in that at the end of the day. It might have just been AI vocals, and then the rest of the music was made by a person, and that's why it sounded good. But yeah, I mean, besides that one Travis Scott thing, it was not on my radar. I didn't have curiosity about it, because I just didn't think it was anywhere close to hitting us.
Right.
And the first time that I got curious was a publicist that I work with a lot hit me up and said he had a new client who was an AI music company. And this was right around the time that ChatGPT came out. So this was fall 2022.
Okay.
And he hit me up and he was like, they're doing something really interesting with songwriting camps. And for context, I was hired at Billboard to be the music publishing reporter. That was my first role. Okay. So a music publishing reporter was responsible for covering the publishing side of music, which is essentially the songwriting side of music, for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what that is. I was covering songwriters pretty extensively, and him pitching it to me as essentially a songwriting story where this AI music company was throwing songwriting camps, I thought that was interesting. So I got on the phone with the founder of this company, and he played me some stuff that wasn't bad. And that's when a light bulb went off for me. And I was like, okay, ChatGPT just came out. One of those image generators, I'm now forgetting which. But like the image generators just started coming out. So that was right around that time. No one was talking about music yet, but this one startup had approached me about it. And I was intrigued. And then I started doing research and I decided I wanted to do a story on how AI would impact the songwriting process. And I'm pretty sure that was basically what the title of the story ended up being. I did, I think, 20 interviews for that, which was nuts. Like most stories like that, I think I expect to do like 5 or 7 max, but I realized how little I knew about the space when I started doing the reporting, and I kept getting deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole and realizing that there were a lot of things going on that I was not aware of. And I released that story and it went viral in the circles of like the music industry that I was reporting on, and people were really mad about the story. I think I don't know that they were necessarily mad at me, but I think they were like shocked and frustrated and upset by the fact that I was saying that it was good and that it was going to be a threat. And I think people were in denial, and it didn't happen until about 6 months later, May 2023, that ghostwriter, who was essentially a guy who was on TikTok, he wore a white bed sheet and sunglasses. Yeah. And he showed everyone this quote unquote AI song that he made. It was called Heart on My Sleeve, also known as like the fake Drake song now. But yeah, I deep faked the voices of Drake and The Weeknd.
So nice.
And and that was the moment when I think everyone woke up in the music industry and were like, oh, okay, this is not a bad song.
Right.
And this is actually happening. And so I covered that story extensively, and I just kind of became our AI person because we didn't have anyone who was covering that. And I really felt like it was a songwriter based story because this was a disruption in the music creation space, unlike anything we had seen before. So long-winded answer, but that's kind of how I ended up getting into the AI stuff.
That's so interesting. It's even as much as I use like AI now, I'm still really freaked out by like just admitting or saying that in like my day to day. But then when I think you hear it, especially when it's like representative of art, it's like you can't quite intellectualize whether this is right or wrong, because if it sounds good, that's how you determine if you like a song, whether it's made from, you know, a songwriter or AI.
Yeah.
In your view, like what would you say is, or even like, I guess I was going to say for the general public, but also like industry insiders, like what's the biggest misconception about AI in music?
Ooh, man. I think one of the biggest misconceptions historically meaning like the last couple of years, right? Is, I mean, not a pretty short history here. But for a really long time, I think people really struggled to understand like, what does it mean when someone says this is an AI song? I still think that's a problem. I think people are a little bit more educated now, but the Ghostwriter track, for example, that was touted as a AI generated song, and it wasn't. It was made by a person, and then he just put fake AI generated vocals on it. And I think that people still tend to see AI music as black or white. So it's either all AI or it's all human. And the fact is, I think we're in a gray area most of the time.
Yeah.
The Ghostwriter song was definitely in a gray area. I think still most of the time that we hear about AI music, there is a decent level of human input, whether the human wrote the lyrics or maybe they generated the song, but then tweaked it.
Right.
I think another misconception though, that is happening right now, is I don't think people realize how often songwriters and producers are like low key trying this stuff out, like big people. No one wants to be public about it, but pretty much everyone's tried it. And most people are pretty wowed by like your Suno and Udio, like tools that are out there.
Right.
That doesn't mean that necessarily makes it onto Spotify, but they're definitely using it. And, I mean, I've heard of a lot of songwriters that will use it in the studio for inspiration. And like, let's say they hit generate and it has a cool guitar riff, they'll just copy the guitar riff on their actual guitar and then throw out the Suno track that had the AI guitar.
Yeah.
And so it might not, the recording might not end up being AI, but it's still influencing some people's writing, which is crazy.
Yeah, so. That is. It's almost like a production tool in a sense, because it's like, mm-hmm. it's like a producer in a way, in that if you're using it like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to end up using Suno and other tools like it, like a collaborator.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, there is some magic to getting into a room with other people 100%. And bouncing ideas off of other people. So what does that mean for songwriters? Does that mean people are doing less sessions? Does that mean, I don't know, it probably means people are putting out more songs if they can write faster with essentially an AI buddy next to them, helping them refine things faster. I don't know. It's going to have some strange consequences. And I do fear that, you know, it could cut down on the amount of collaboration between people.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I keep thinking my dad is like a singer songwriter on the side for like as a hobby. And he recently has discovered using AI to like generate songs. And he'll like be like, check out this song. Like I came up with the concept, but it put it together. And I'm always bothered by it though, because I'm like, but it's a hobby. Like you're taking, like, if that's the joy is to create something and you're having something create it for you, then like, what is the creativity part of it? Mm-hmm. But I do kind of now see the perspective of it as more of a tool as opposed to like the black and white, like this is now who's in the creative control of the song, yeah. I guess.
I mean, I think we, I mean, there are people like your Kanye West of the world that like are the types of creatives that do a lot of like direction of other people in a studio. And so one could argue, if you wanted to, that like being a music curator of sorts with AI or with other people in the room and kind of like almost like executive producing something that AI is doing most of the legwork on, maybe there is still merit to that. I don't know. I completely understand if someone's listening to this and say like, absolutely not. Or if someone says absolutely yes. But I mean, one of the things I definitely hear a lot is in an age of AI, your taste and your curation are probably going to be your greatest assets as a person.
Right.
Cause anyone can generate a song, but if your dad knows how to prompt it, and he also can tell among the 12 songs he generated on that topic which one is actually worth sharing, then I don't know, maybe there's a skill to that.
No, that's an interesting point. Like it's like almost the creative director of the whole thing. Yeah, I can see how Kanye was a good example of that. Also, back to the ghostwriter, correct me if I'm wrong, did he later release a version that did not use AI so that he could qualify for the Grammys? Okay.
This is a great question. He first teased it on TikTok. That's how it went viral. And he put it up on Spotify with the fake voices, with Drake and The Weeknd's fake voices on there. Pretty immediately, UMG, who is the label for both Drake and The Weeknd, found a way to get it taken down. It was actually kind of challenging to get it taken down because your voice is not copyrightable. It's a different type of right called a publicity right. So there is a system set up for getting things taken down if it violates copyrights, but not one for violating rights of publicity. So it ended up being like a little bit weird and wonky how they got it taken down, but they did.
Okay.
And then after that, Ghostwriter released the song again with regular vocals, but he didn't announce it. And I'm pretty sure the reason was it like went really under the radar. I don't even know if it's still up, but there was this whole thing where Ghostwriter wanted to get nominated for a Grammy. So this is like a few months after the TikTok hype and the initial story died down. They wanted to get nominated for a Grammy, and the Recording Academy essentially said like, you can submit a song that contains AI elements, but it can't violate any of our other policies. And I think the fact that he used a fake, if this interests anyone listening, please go look up this, because I did write about it at the time.
Yes.
But it's been a few years. So for some reason or another, the way around this rule with the Recording Academy was to submit the song with just regular human vocals. So basically it's a human song. Right. And they did upload that version to Spotify because I think you do have to commercially release a song if you're going to submit it for a Grammy. So anyways, it's like this whole loophole. So this person who is known for using AI didn't use AI and submitted the human version of his song. It's all really weird. But yeah, he didn't get nominated for a Grammy, plot twist. So yeah.
Well, do you see that as a statement that he was making about like the legitimacy of his song? Like, I guess like, yeah, what was the motivation behind redoing it?
Yeah. So I ultimately did do an interview with Ghostwriter. It was a digital cover for us in that fall. And it was around all this Grammy, you know, craziness that was happening. And I think that Ghost decided to do the interview with me because I think he did really want to prove that he is a trained musician and that AI was a tool rather than something that did all the work for him.
Right.
And so I think it was probably equal parts. I want to get nominated for a Grammy and break barriers and be a big grab, big headlines with the fact that he used AI. I think he liked being controversial, but he also wanted to send the message that he was talented and that talented people can use this for interesting purposes that people haven't thought of yet. Yeah. So I couldn't say exactly what his motivation was, but based on the conversation, it really felt like those were the two main drivers.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Even how he like would visually represent himself, I think is applicable to that in a weird way where it's like, he's creating such an overt identity of like being a ghostwriter, but at the same time, it's so anonymous and you're not really focused. I don't know. There's something there, I think, that like correlates with what you're saying. Yeah. I guess it's just in terms of like, you know, for detecting fraud or like suspicious royalty claims and things like that, like where humans are clearly like, you know, spearheading that. Do you see it as being more
like playing the system?
Right. Like, is it more of a benefit in some ways, or does it still come across more threatening than what it could be beneficial towards?
So yeah, I know what you're saying. I think that right now AI is making the streaming fraud / artificial streaming problem that streaming services definitely have worse. Mm-hmm. I do think you could fight AI with more AI.
Right.
You know, right now, and I want to be clear that this is what one company is saying is happening. I have not been able to verify whether or not that's exactly true, but Deezer, a French streaming service, has been very vocal about how AI is being or is making its way onto its platform. So in one of their reports, they said that they have found that up to 70% of streams on what they've detected as AI generated tracks are fraudulent. Wow. So they are not real. They're not actually coming from someone like you or me. They're a scam so that people can make money from the royalty pool that Deezer has to pay out to artists. I think if that's true, that's really glaring. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem. And I mean, if I'm putting on my fraudster hat and I'm thinking about like, how could I commit fraud? I would do that too. Like that it's the easiest thing in the world to just click generate right. over and over again and get hundreds or thousands of songs and then upload them like via TuneCore or like a distributor that is pretty open-ended and then run a bot farm because, or just hope and pray that maybe someone finds it for some reason and it starts blowing up. It makes a lot of sense because the more songs you have to spread your fake streams out on, the more songs you have, the more likely it is that you won't get caught, or the more likely it is that only some of those songs get caught and taken down, but maybe a few of them stay up and still make money for you.
Right.
So I think right now AI is making the streaming fraud problem way worse. Also, you have plenty of people who've probably gotten away with impersonations of famous artists on streaming services. I know they're all scanning for that, the impersonation bit very closely, but that doesn't mean they're catching all of it.
Yeah.
That being said, non-generative AI, just like kind of like an AI-powered tool.
Right.
could be used on the back end of streaming services, and probably some form of AI already is,
right,
to try to decrease this problem, trying to scan for suspicious activity and flag it to the team so that, right, they can decide whether or not they want to take down tracks that seem off. Mm-hmm. So I do think it can help, but I mean, I think it would be easier if this just, if this technology was not part of the conversation at all.
Yeah.
Or maybe we could even just say that, like, generative AI is worsening fraud. Maybe non-generative AI is helping.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, no, you explained that super well. I think it's almost like it needs to be used as a tool and not as a replacement for something bigger than something that's supplementary to a larger responsibility of, like, let's say checking, like what you were saying, like used to scan, you know, initially, but then the people who are actually looking at the flags are the ones that should be determining the, like, validity in that.
Yeah.
Even prior to AI, like, artist fraud and, like, song fraud is such a thing. Like, whenever on my release radar on Spotify, you know, you'll see, like, oh, there's a new song from this band that hasn't been together in 40 years. And then you realize it's, like, someone just logged it, right, as the name of an existing artist.
Yeah, that's definitely a big problem, too. I didn't realize that there was a term for this, but it's called content mismatch. If I were to go in and say, like, Stevie Nicks wrote this song, even if it's up on Stevie Nicks's page for a few days before it gets taken down and properly categorized as someone else's song, it will get pushed in the algorithm towards your release radar, your Discover Weekly, whatever,
yeah,
and can earn streams. It's definitely another really frustrating thing for artists on streaming services.
Right. Yeah. There's just so many things, I think, if from a listener's perspective, they probably, yeah, don't realize the frustration because of, like, all of the time, effort, and money that goes into that kind of a thing. So it is really interesting. And then also, mm-hmm, I'm curious, like, because you know, this is so complex, and I think you do a really good job of not, like, alienating your readers from, like, you know, whether they're inside the business or they're not, how do you find sort of, like, a balance of being able to reach your audiences because you're kind of speaking to both more of the music business side, mm-hmm, and more of the, like, consumer side?
Well, thank you for saying that. I never know if I actually am doing a good job.
So. You definitely are.
So at Billboard, because Billboard has historically been, like, the big trade publication for the music business, and a lot of my content is behind the paywall for people who are mostly professionals or aspiring professionals that have subscriptions. When I'm writing, I tend to go a little bit more towards the niche of a business audience. Mm-hmm. But I've started making short form videos to explain my stories. And I found that that has found a bigger audience than I expected it to. I've always found the music business to be very interesting. I've always found AI, fraud, those kind of topics to be really interesting.
Yeah.
But I was hoping that other people would too, if they were just able to understand it. And I have found that through making TikToks and reels and stuff like that, that I've learned how to speak better to someone who doesn't have any experience in this field. And I think that people also like getting their content delivered in that way. Sometimes, yeah. I know I like scrolling on social media. I wish I could say I didn't, but
totally.
I do.
Yeah.
So I'm like meeting people where they're at, and, like, you know, hopefully that's like the discovery portion of my work. And then if someone likes it, then they'll maybe subscribe to Billboard Pro or maybe check out some of my stories.
Yeah.
And from there, I mean, I definitely try to define any terms I think could be a stumbling point, I guess, for some folks. But I do think, like, my writing can be pretty businessy or high level, I guess, for someone who's already familiar with the topic.
Yeah. But I think to your point, exactly what you're saying, like, you bridge that gap really well, because, like, that's what it should be, right? Like, it's, like you said, it's a trade publication. This is one of the only resources really that goes into the music business side of things, but you make it so accessible, mm-hmm, for people who are at any stage or any side of the industry, whether they're just a listener or they're starting a music career. I think the TikToks and videos, I mean, I always stop and watch them.
That's great. I love that. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a grind, because, like, there's plenty to do as a journalist without making social media posts. But I do think it's important for, you know, like just meeting people where they're at. And some people just might not know what we have behind our paywall. And if I can do a video that makes them realize, oh, I'm actually really fascinated by this topic to the point where I want to keep up with this. I don't know. Maybe I've made a couple subscribers. I don't know. But that's also like, I just started like a podcast about the music business because I do want it to be a way for people to discover what I'm writing about and what my coworkers are writing about behind the paywall. I understand a paywall can be tough for people and frustrating. And I think that this is like a way to just be like, here's a taste test of what we have. If you like it, keep going deeper and deeper.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Yeah. So. No, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to say congrats on the recent launch of On the Record. I listened to the first two episodes. So great. And to your point, like, I think you're doing exactly what you're saying. It's sort of creating like a legacy of like making a really possibly intimidating topic feel a little bit more like attainable and more like curiosity. Like with the episode about the Sphere, like I was impressed by how broken down and like less intimidating like it was once hearing about it, because it seemed like, you know, literally a sphere, like just such a large complex thing. But like, yeah, I think having those conversations with the people behind it really personalizes it and makes it more accessible.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's fun. And like, I love picking out the topics because there's so many things I'm fascinated by. And like I was kind of saying before, one of the big reasons why I like writing is I've gotten to meet cool people. And I'm sure you feel the same way about this podcast. Like, it's just a great opportunity to have a good conversation with someone.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you find that like you're coming across new, different types of challenges with podcasting compared to like traditional written journalism?
Yes.
I'm sure I can relate to an extent.
Yeah. I'm like, I think I'm probably talking to the right person here. I think video podcasts are way harder than people think they are. I think podcasting in general is harder than people think it is. Yes. Video podcasting is basically a talk show. Yeah. So it's a really big commitment. And it's important to me that I still am able to do reporting and writing. So juggling those two things has been a challenge, but I know that it's just only going to get easier as I get the hang of it. But with a video podcast, I think one challenge that I didn't anticipate, but maybe I should have, is like, for example, I've been trying to book an artist, a female artist, who typically has like really great glam at all times, and trying to get her to come to our studio at a certain time in full glam is really challenging. And like, that's an extra step for her. And if this was an audio only podcast, or if this was just a Zoom call, for one of my stories where I was just going to be transcribing the words, like it could be done at any time for her. But I have to take into account that for some people, it's a pretty big challenge to come in and do all of that. So
yeah,
it's stuff like that.
It's also hilarious. I only do audio.
Oh, whoa.
It's like, on the other hand, I find audio to be really challenging because it's not social, like content friendly.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, how can I create a personal connection with my listeners when they don't see me, or I'm not, you know, if it's audio only, it's so much harder to come up with like content that you stop when you're scrolling.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. That's why I wanted to go and do the extra step of doing the video from the start.
Yeah.
And like, I definitely thought about like, this would probably be easier if I just did audio. Like, there's probably a lot more guests who would be able to come on if I just did audio.
Right.
And I think if I had started earlier, audio was the thing. But right now there's like this wave of video podcasts, and who knows, maybe it's very possible that we look back on this time and be like, wow, everyone wasted so much production value on video podcasts and it didn't need to be that way. But right now that's like what the thing is. And I thought it was important for us as a brand when we went out with it, that we just went all in.
Yeah.
I think the weekly cadence is tough too. You can look up and realize that, oh my gosh, the week that I hadn't booked is like 2 weeks from now.
Yep.
And now I need to, but then I need to film it a few days before it comes out. So now I actually only have a week.
Yeah. It's really nice to talk to a guest who really understands this. Like, yeah. it's like a, such a cycle. And then when you think you're done with the cycle, the next, I guess it's kind of like releasing music. Yeah. It's the same thing. It's like, oh, you're done with like, you know, the album cycle, mm-hmm. but then you have a single or something. It's just, yeah, there's a lot of work behind the scenes and in front of the scenes. But I think, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, like you're fostering something that you're so passionate about, and you're not only learning for yourself, but you're exposing it to such a wide audience of people who will really benefit from it. So I'm excited to see how it continues to grow. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. In one of your videos, one of the things that sort of we're losing in the digital world are these like real connections, real experiences, like you had said, like maybe teams working together in a studio, or even just like, I'm thinking fan to artist, like, you know, because fans have a big role in determining an artist's success. And I know that you, like I said, you in one of your videos, short form videos, you emphasize how important those like in-person events are. Can you kind of speak to that, of like what value they kind of add to the overall success for an artist?
Yeah, I think that when you get someone to show up in person for a concert or a meet and greet, typically for an artist, it would be just like a concert. It creates a bond that is much harder to break. And I think that one of the things in digital marketing that I find to be really exciting right now is there's kind of been a push back towards getting people in person, because marketers know, like, if I can just get them to go to a cool event, we could do a stunt at the event. We could do something that is like totally viral worthy and get them to take videos at the event so they can keep it forever on their camera roll and feel like they had this amazing experience that they'll have documented forever, or they'll share it with their friends on TikTok or social media. And really wonderful pairing. But I think post-pandemic, people are longing to be outside again.
Yeah.
You know, these kind of marketing tactics are not revolutionary. It's not like they haven't happened before, but I think post-pandemic, there's been a real push back outside. Mm-hmm. And I think you can also see it in other areas of life. I mean, people are sick of dating apps and they want to be doing a run club or, you know, like an activity-based life. I think that people are longing to see each other in person. And I think that music is no different. And I think we've even seen really great breakthroughs from artists who could probably in part attribute their growth to going on tour. Mm. Chapel Roan opening for Olivia Rodrigo, that coincided with her meteoric rise pretty closely. I mean, that's not the only reason why she blew up. There were plenty of other reasons, but I think that that tour was really important. I think the Eras tour booking Sabrina Carpenter and Gracie Abrams, like, it felt like everyone who went on the Eras tour has just exploded like months after, or even during their run on the Eras tour. So I think in-person experiences create fans for life if you can get them there.
Yeah.
But it is hard to get them there. You have to find a way to get them to spend money, go through the dreaded Ticketmaster queue and actually get there. So
Yeah. I think that's such a good point of just that human connection. And I've been like going to more shows again, like, and I've just been noticing like more of the activations that kind of like companion like with the show. Like, for example, even I'm thinking like Taylor Swift's album coming out this week. She has like the theater. I'm not a Swiftie, so I'm not like super in knowing, but like, I know she's doing a lot of like in-person activations, or people are buying tickets even for the activation itself. And even for someone
who she doesn't even necessarily have to be there.
Exactly. Like, right.
If it's themed, you know, like that can be really cool too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's proven to be really successful. So it's cool to see. Yeah. And I guess to kind of wrap things up, like were to imagine if AI is here to stay, like how do you see it evolving specifically in music when it comes to an artist and like their creativity?
I think that AI assisted songwriting is going to become pretty normal to the point where we stop talking about it. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're there yet. And I'm sure someone listening will probably say that's crazy, but I don't know, just based on like the the quieter conversations I've had, not for stories, just one-on-one with songwriters and producers, the amount of times that it's being used, especially like in terms of having writer's block or something, using it as a way to jumpstart your next song idea. I think that that will be pretty normalized. I don't know if the AI will make it into the final master recording. I think sometimes it will. Right. I think a lot of times it won't, but it's going to be interesting to see. And I think we're also going to have to watch and see how streaming services deal with AI music and the gray area that is AI assisted music. Yep. If there is some sort of royalty, a lesser royalty earned if you've used AI, then I could see that being a deterrent for a lot of people using it. Mm-hmm. But also, let's say they never discriminate and AI music is worth the same as human-made music, which is how it is right now, then if that's true, then maybe it'll be normalized. So I think that the mode of consumption actually will be a big driver, like how these streaming services, the end place where you put your music and how they treat it and how they pay it out is going to really have an influence over its creative use in the studio.
Really well said. Yeah. Even from a larger perspective, it's already becoming so normalized. Just like ChatGPT has become a verb like in our day-to-day at this point. And it's kind of happening without us even realizing. So I think to your point, like it will become probably at a place where it's just supplemental and part of what, you know, the creative process looks like without having to really call it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But my last question, if you had to give your music career so far an album name, what would you title it?
Okay. Honestly, I'd just say like try hard.
So, I like it.
I wish I could just say that I'm like cool and like all this stuff just happened to me, but I try really hard. And you know, like I do think I've been thinking about, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent now, but I do think that I think a lot of people resonate with Taylor Swift. I'm a fan. I'm not a super fan. She has a lot of misses for me, but I still appreciate her. But I think one of the things that people really like about her is that you can see how hard she's trying and she's not effortless at all. And I do think that that is the biggest appeal of her to me. Because I feel like I don't know. I do know people in my life who just like cool things just happen to them. And I don't know how, but I'm like, like I wanted to be in music since I was like 10 and like, I tried for that.
Right.
It's not like, things just happened. So I guess that would be my album title.
That's really great. I think that will resonate so much and like be a relief for a lot of listeners because I think there is something, that's such a good point about Taylor Swift. I never really thought about it, but like, that is such an appeal. Like she does not try to give this facade of like, she just woke up and she's who she is. Like the effort proves itself. And yeah, I'm excited for you and to see where it continues for you. I think it's really exciting and I'm excited for all the opportunities that you're working through.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for having me on. This was really fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And where can people find you and everything that you're doing?
Okay. On pretty much all forms of social media. I'm at Words by Kristin, KRISTIN. People get that wrong. And I do have this podcast. It's called On the Record. And we have a dedicated Instagram account for it that you can follow along with. It's at Billboard On the Record. So
awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you again.
Certain of the truth.